Now's the time to tell that wonderful story of the little boy. He was about 2 or 3 years old, and he went in the icebox to get some milk, and he managed to get this big carton and spill it all over the floor. Now, needless to say, there'd be a lot of parents that would react very negatively and frustrated. And well, this mother happened to be a scientist. So she came in, she saw the puddle of milk, saw what had happened, and went and got some paper towels, put them on the floor, on the milk, and said, look at this. Look how the milk starts creeping up these fibers of the towel. Isn't that cool? That's really neat. And just said, look, if you got something heavy you need to get out of the refrigerator, feel free to call me. But how neat is this, the way the milk is being absorbed by the towel? Well, she was a scientist, and he became a world-class scientist. So she motivated, she understood his interest, or turned it into interest, actually, instead of a fear-inducing result. Fear and shame and all the negative affects that could have been coming about if she had handled it differently. Instead, she put a sense of joy and interest in being intrigued with his interests and turned the whole thing around.
Welcome to the IPA Podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Paul Hollinger. Paul is a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst. He's the faculty and former dean at the Chicago Psychoanalytic Institute, where he is also a training and supervising and child and adult supervising analyst. Paul has published widely and is very active in the world of especially child analysis. And our conversation today revolves around his work as represented in his new book, Affects, Cognition, and Language as Foundations of Human Development. And we go through the book focusing on the ways that affects are the building block of a sense of self in the world. And we also discuss the ways that a child's environment either supports or undermines their developing sense of self and their specifically their affect of curiosity. We talk about cognitive development and language, how it develops in childhood and how it shows itself in the clinical situation. And we pay special attention to an area of interest of his, which is the destructive role of corporal punishment, both in a child's development and in society at large. We also talk about a foundation he is actively involved in supporting adolescents who are struggling. And we open and close with the opening and closing of his book, which are quotes from Lincoln. He's a longstanding student of and admirer of the man and his work. And it suits Paul very well. He's an old friend. He has much to teach us, and I hope you enjoy this as I did. Paul, welcome. You know, Paul, I've known you for so long. It's a special pleasure to welcome you to the podcast. And knowing you as I have, I wasn't at all surprised to see that you began and closed your book that will be the focus of our conversation today with quotes from Abraham Lincoln. Those who know you are a lifelong student of the man and his work. And that and your love of baseball are two of your important avocations. But those who know you also know that your passion is the betterment of the emotional lives of children. And you've devoted yourself to that in many ways that we're going to take up today. First and foremost is your hands-on clinical work and teaching. Beyond that, a lifelong interest of yours is about letting the public know about the dangers, indeed destructiveness, of corporal punishment. And we will discuss that. What most people will not know about you is that you've also been very involved for a very long time with a foundation out of northern Wisconsin that's devoted to the, both the financial and emotional needs of struggling teenagers. But I want to start us off with this quote about corporal punishment, because there are many, bullet points that came to me from reading this book that have stayed with me. And I know that this is very important to you and that you would want the listener to receive that from you. And that is, and we will get to this in more detail, but you make the point that the term spanking, which almost has a playful quality to it, maybe because it's associated for some with the adult version of it, but spanking is indeed hitting. And hitting is, in fact, the crime of battery. And it's to be taken seriously as that. Again, as I say, we will get to that in a bit. But I want to start us off with that quote from Lincoln. This is from page one in the book, and it's from his House Divided speech from 1858. And he writes, "If we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could better judge what to do and how to do it." Simple statement, as many of his were, and profound. You're laughing.
Yeah, no, you're right. The way he had a capacity to put things directly, seemingly simple, but remarkably profound.
Yes, yes. And I'm looking forward to reading the closing quote from him as well. But as I mentioned, the book is divided into three sections: affects, cognition, and language as part of human development. And the first section, the largest section, is on affect. And you begin recognizing the work of Sylvan Tompkins, who you highly value and use in your thinking and clinical work. And for the many who may not be familiar with him, let me just read a few sentences that you wrote, and then I'll ask you to elaborate what's important about his thinking. You write, "Tompkins laid the groundwork for understanding affects, and since his death, the bulk of recent neurophysiologic research has tended to support the basic idea of innate affects." You go on and you say, "Affects interact with themselves in various ways and can be innate activators of other affects. For example, anger can be triggered by distress as well as by an excessively sustained level of the other negative affects, such as fear, shame, disgust, dismal, or positive affects, in fact, too long sustained excitement. The interruption of interest can lead to distress and then anger. And shame is a specific inhibitor of continuing interest and enjoyment. Furthermore, affects themselves may act as regulators and modulators of other affects. For example, activation of the positive affect of interest can diminish fear and distress." This is something that you emphasize, and we're going to come back to this affect of interest and how important it is. But start us off, Paul. Tell us about Tompkins and what drew you to his work.
I think most people who plunge into this, well, first of all, let me go back. Thank you for the kind words. And I wish you'd give me about 20 minutes to say similar kind words about yourself and the work you're doing now and the work that you have done. Really, really, really remarkable. And I thank you for that. The field thanks you for that. So Tompkins wrote a remarkable book in 60 and then wrote some more. He has a series of four in the late 70s and 80s. And he, to make a long story short, he helped us understand that feelings or affects, there are about eight or nine of them that can be identified with the pictures of youngsters at a very, very early age. In other words, In other words, stimuli trigger feelings, stimuli trigger affects. And in the infants, you can see those affective expressions very clearly. And there are nine of them. Interestingly enough, there are really only two so-called positive affects, interest and enjoyment. There's a surprise affect, which resets the whole system. And then there are negative affects or negative feelings. So we'll stick with feelings. Johnny tells me, my wife tells me, stop using the word affects and use feelings in terms of trying to get points across. So the six negative feelings are distress, anger, fear, shame, and then two bodily reactions that are also psychological reactions, disgust and dismay.
Can you share with us what dismay is?
Yeah, dismay is the physical response is the wrinkling of the nose and the turning of the head. And that's, you can see that in an infant. It's very, very interesting if you take a look at the pictures. Give me 2 seconds here, or maybe not. We'll come across
I might say that the book is replete with pictures, not just of these examples of infant faces, but also there are pictures of the many contributors that you describe. That is, that you give photographs of them. What led you to do that? I was drawn to that.
I think because it's so prominent, and it highlights that this is the real deal, that if we want to understand what's going on in somebody, you can understand it through taking a look at the pictures and understanding the specific feelings. So, for instance, fear will often trigger anger. Shame will often trigger anger. These things interact, they impact each other. And it's important to know it in doing clinical work, what's going on. And this is like a dictionary of what's going on internally.
And we're gonna take up in a moment a clinical example where an appreciation of affects or feelings were central to sort of righting the ship of ongoing therapy. You also have photographs of the individuals, the clinicians and researchers throughout the book. What led you to do that? Because it's characteristic of the book. Every few pages is a picture of another contributor. What led you to do that?
Two things. One is actually a remarkable biography of Lincoln that has come out recently, but unfortunately the author, I don't think, is alive to finish the part about Lincoln's time in the White House. But he used pictures beautifully in terms of highlighting. It brings it to life, to make a long story short.
I understand. Yes. No, it does do that. Yes.
And that we've got so many good people that I wanted to try to bring this stuff to life, because it's also can get kind of burdensome with just the reading.
So you mentioned the clinical importance of affects and feelings, and you give a case study of Dr. B, who's a therapist, who was seeking consultation because she was treating an individual in twice weekly psychotherapy, a young woman, 28-year-old secretary, who was struggling post-divorce and was struggling in order to separate herself from her former husband and wasn't doing well with it. And you write that the clinician was highlighting the patient's apprehension about beginning treatment, her difficulties trusting the therapist, and the various displacements and resistances involved, and exploring the possibility that the patient's distressing feelings for and interactions with her ex-husband were reflections of aspects of her early object relations. This all sounded very cognitive to me. And then the therapist sought consultation. And you write, her consultant made what seemed to be a deceptively simple observation and suggestion. In short, she suggested a focus on Ms. N's affect and current object of that affect, namely, how it was so horribly painful, distressing, embarrassing, humiliating, still to be wrapped up so intensely and erratically with her ex-husband and not be able to break away to resolve it somehow. And as she shifted the nature of her interventions over the following weeks, Dr. B noted that Ms. N, her patient, seemed to respond much more positively to treatment. Ms. N described a feeling of being better understood and a sense of relief. She began tearfully elaborating on her feelings for her ex-husband, the pros and cons of that relationship, and her sense of loss, and she appeared to begin a mourning process. and her disruptive behavior, including with her ex-husband, began to dissipate. It's a real-life hands-on example of how tempting it can be to start talking about ideas and your emphasis is on, that's not where the heart of the matter is. It's in the clinical, it's in the affect of the clinical moment. Anything you want to add to that?
Well, just to go back for a second, just to clear up disgust. Disgust is rejection and dismell is contempt. And they both have very clear facial features when you trigger those things in babies. So we've got pictures of that in the book. No, you said it nicely that the therapist was trying to get a handle on this, but she continued to get wrapped up in her husband, the rage at her ex-husband, her pain, but she couldn't do anything with it. And it was a hodgepodge. There was a decent relationship and positive transferences to some extent with the therapist, but it wasn't going anywhere and it wasn't getting cleared up. And the consultant began to recognize, I suppose, both from baby work, but also what people like Bosch and John Ghetto talk about, that you've got to put these affects into words. You have to identify them in order to make them come alive in the brain. So that's what they started to do. She could begin to put into her vocabulary if something was distressing or enraging or shaming, embarrassing, humiliating, and then things started to click and started to become much, much clearer to her as she began to realize how she really felt. We use so much when you hear clinical presentations, so much about how the person got into the affects and were expressing their emotions and this and that, but you very rarely, or not often enough, I think, hear about what the feelings were. Was the person scared? Were they angry? Were they more than angry? Were they enraged? Was there something of interest to them? And when you start to parse that out and put that into words, it makes a huge difference. Now that's where this whole thing is really fascinating, because we're talking about what goes on and how the brain gets built and all in terms of socially very, very early on. So then as you go up the ladder, or this triad, as we've talked about, gone from feelings to cognition to language, the brain and the infant and then child have more assets at their hands, and it makes for a much more rounded emotional state. And then similarly with adults, the same thing either happens or doesn't happen. They may have a capacity to understand and talk about their feelings, but not have tapped into their own creativity, how smart or how limited they are in terms of their cognitive capacities. And we'll see that later, how remarkably smart young babies are. And then ultimately putting things into words. And when we talk about, Annie Cattan and her remarkable work with young children who are out of control and limited and all of this, when they start putting words to the feelings, how it turns all of that around. And maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves, but that's
where... Yeah, we will get to that. I want to stay in the area of affect, because one of the chapters on affect that so caught my interest was a chapter entitled "The Affect of Interest, the Core of Our Existence." And you write, clinically, one of the most important accomplishments a therapist can achieve in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy is helping a patient find increased interest and curiosity about his or her motives, behaviors, and relationships to the external world. In other words, their self-reflective capacities. The impact of inhibited interest in childhood can have a profound ripple effect on the individual and society, i.e., it nurtures bias and prejudice. But the transformation of affects such as fear, surprise, and disgust into interest enhances learning and understanding. Now, the idea that our function as clinicians is to encourage self-awareness is certainly familiar to me. But you introduce a new notion, to me anyway, which is that the inhibition of interest leads to bias and prejudice. I dare say that with all the conversation and reflections on bias and prejudice these days, as important as that is, I've never heard it linked to inhibitions in interest in childhood. So tell us more about that.
So all the negative affects can respond positively to interest or curiosity. Who is it that, we'll get to that later, to our wonderful scientists who worked in the, Madame Curie. Madame Curie says, nothing in life is to be feared. It is only to be understood. Now is the time to understand more so that we may fear less. She nailed it.
Mm-hmm.
She understood in her own way that if you've got affects like anger or fear or shame, that the issue is mobilizing curiosity and trying to understand what's going on, and then going from there. And that's why, as you say, with the physical punishment issue, where the bias and prejudice have become so important. So clinically, if you can, in the midst of the anger, mobilize self-reflection, curiosity. Why am I feeling so angry about that? What happened in the past? What happened in the present? What does this person look like that's making me feel this way? More from the affect to the affect of interest. And that's huge, both clinically and it's huge for living life.
Yes, it is.
And that's what in that, just to go back for a sec to that case study with Dr. B, that was what they did, and started putting her feelings into words and then getting her curious about why she might be feeling that way and going from there. And then things started to settle down, to get organized. She wasn't as disorganized, and she began to understand herself and why that relationship went awry and what she could do to carve out a better life for herself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Locating the affective surface, certainly. You have a wonderful example. Let me read. It's about Brett. You write, years ago, I was visiting my friend Roger, his wife Sally, and their 1.5-year-old son, Brett. Brett was eating in his high chair, and at one point, he slowly picked up a pea and dropped it on the floor. Then he did this with a second pea and a third, and I was entranced, and so was he, riveted as the pea fell to the floor. He seemed to like peas as he was eating them as well. I took a pea and joined him. I dropped it on the floor. He was intrigued. I had read Alison Gopnik's work, the book is The Scientist in the Crib, on children's learning and hypothesis testing. Was he checking out gravity? Would the peas bounce like a ball? Was he bored or just trying to get some interaction with his parents or me? So I got into a little trouble with Roger and Sally, which was followed by interesting discussions. Was I encouraging malfeasance and messiness? Or were Brett and I engaged in scientific exploration? Or both? It's a charming story. And there are more like it, I know, that you have both in the book and otherwise. But tell us about this burgeoning scientific curiosity that you facilitate engagement in.
I think that's where Alison Gopnik has helped us a great deal. Understanding this affect of interest and curiosity, and the importance of it, that in terms of a sense, that's where Kohut's helped us also, in terms of self psychology.
Can you just briefly, since you mentioned it, I wouldn't have jumped to Kohut and self curiosity, but tell me how you make a link.
Because Kohut was so focused on one sense of self and what disrupted a sense of self and what enhanced a sense of self. And what makes a sense of self is what a person is interested in, who they are, what they're genuinely interested in, and trying not to derail that. I mean, how many, on the negative side, why are you so interested in that train? Or why, go play with something else. But I know what the child is interested in. That's what counts. That's kind of what much of what the first part of the book is about, and people, and people like Winnicott and a host of other people saying that what really counts is what the child is intrigued with, because you want to mobilize interest, because that's what's going to, and it may shift around, as it obviously does. Everybody sees, you know, in childhood, you know, you may go from tennis to books to baseball to God only knows what, and it'll settle that. But if you undermine the sense of interest, you're undermining the person's sense of self, and that's not going to work out well. So back to the piece and the kids being scientists and being so interested in that, and you want to enhance that. I think now's the time to tell that wonderful story of the little boy. He was about 2 or 3 years old, and he went in the icebox to get some milk, and he managed to get this big carton and spill it all over the floor. Now, needless to say, there'd be a lot of parents that would react very negatively and frustrated, and, you know, if they're whatever. Well, this mother happened to be a scientist. So she came in, she saw the puddle of milk, saw what had happened, and went and got some paper towels, put them on the floor, on the milk, and said, look at this. Look how the milk starts creeping up these fibers of the towel. Isn't that cool? That's really neat. And, just said, look, if you got something heavy you need to get out of the refrigerator, feel free to call me. But how neat is this, the way the milk is being absorbed by the towel? Well, she was a scientist, and he became a world-class scientist. So she understood his interest, or turned it into interest, actually, instead of a fear-inducing result. Fear and shame and all the negative affects that could have been coming about if she had handled it differently. Instead, she put a sense of joy and interest in being intrigued with his interests, and turned the whole thing around. In terms of the positive affects of interest and joy, which is what you want in terms of conveying a sense of self.
Every time you share that story, Paul, I have this big smile on my face because I guess the smile and the surprise on my part is because the inclination, I can picture the scene, the kid is nervous, he's made a mess on the floor, and instead, it's turned into a love moment. She's loving his capacity to be curious and encouraging it. And it's such a powerful example to all parents and grandparents who will face these things more often than we care to acknowledge. So thank you for bringing that forward. It's really marvelous.
Can we move a generation later with a kid we did a follow-up study on in child analysis. This adolescent, 17, 18, was becoming a spectacular baseball player, 90, 95 miles an hour, whatever, pitcher. And he liked it at first, but started not to like it, and got very interested in literature and poetry and all of that, and wanted to switch. Well, his father did not want him to switch. He wanted him to be a major league pitcher. Father was a sports fan and all of this. To make a long story short, the kid went sideways for a while, but got into a good child analysis and came out of it 3 or 4 years later, or whatever, going to college and studying literature, and became a terrific teacher in high school and college in literature and poetry. Well, we interviewed the parents also of this small group of eight, which I thought was fascinating because nobody had interviewed parents before. In this kind of a follow-up situation. So the mother got it. She realized that he had liked baseball, but then didn't, and much more liked literature and poetry, and became spectacular at it. We interviewed the father. The father still did not get it. He still wished that his son had gone into baseball and that would have been best for him. So you see the whole question of interest, understanding interest, being able to be, as you say, playful with what the child's interested in, and going in that going in that direction. So there's an example from baby who drops the milk to through adulthood.
There's another brief story that I want to share on that very topic. You write, a child's curiosity and safety often create dilemmas. Virginia Demos gives a nice example. Suppose the infant spots a pair of scissors and crawls towards them. As the infant reaches for them, the caregiver yells, "No, stop!" But, asks Demos, "Stop what?" It's my favorite line in the book. Stop what? Stop being interested in new objects? Stop exploring? The caregiver has acted to help prevent possible harm to the baby, but has not validated the interest affect, helping them safely explore scissors or shifting the interest to a safer object. The command is simply no. Instead, when the child is safe, the caregiver might embrace the curiosity and also explain the potential dangers. But that's the line, stop what? We know what we're referring to when we say stop. But as you so importantly point out, the child just stops. And with it, you point out, the wholesale energy and aliveness of interest in the world around can often get thwarted.
Exactly. Yeah.
We must say something about, speaking of affects, about play. You write, playing then can be defined as the interaction of affects of interest, enjoyment, and surprise. Or to put it differently, the interaction of the affects of interest, enjoyment, and surprise may produce what we call playing. Creating is an extension or cousin of playing, containing new, innovative, imaginative elements. And that's your point. From curiosity, you get imagination and creativity.
Yeah. That's where Stanley Greenspan came in, when he would do his assessments of children on the floor. He'd sit down with the mom and the dad and the child and see, you know, see what was going on with them, see what was of interest and the capacity to assess that and to try to help the parent to understand it, to understand that it was what the child was interested in, and not to dissuade that and not to humiliate the child and all of that.
When discussing affects, of course, we must acknowledge the affect of anger. And who better to teach us about the affect of anger, as you point out in the book, but Aristotle? Marvelous quote that you bring forward from 340 BC. Aristotle writes, "Anyone can get angry, that is easy. But to do this to the right person, to the right extent, at the right time, with the right motive, and in the right way, that is not for everyone, nor is it easy." I don't think I've heard a better, isn't that wonderful? I've never heard a better way to evaluate a person being ready to terminate an analysis than that quote from Aristotle. It's just wonderful.
that's great. Wouldn't it have been nice to have known him?
Yeah. Now, you give a clinical example of this in your work with Elliot. Let me just read a part of it, and then I'll ask you to elaborate on it. Elliot was a 42-year-old unmarried man in analysis. He came for depression, anxiety, and tension. And you write, "One day, about midway through the session, I shifted in my chair, and he burst out, 'God damn it, there you go again, rustling around, just distracted, you don't give a shit.' We were learning in what appeared to be an aspect of negative maternal transference that I was being seen as self-absorbed, easily distracted, disinterested, and not really concerned about him. That day, I had not felt distracted, and I decided to focus on another aspect of the process. You said, 'Sometimes if I move in my chair, it seems to throw you, but other times it doesn't.' 'Well, I think that's so,' he said with less agitation. 'I think at times I just seem to blow. Everything seems so awful, and the slightest thing just pulls me over. Other times, I don't seem as disrupted.' You said, 'The straw that broke the camel's back. Perhaps sometimes you feel so hurt and vulnerable that my shifting around just makes everything too much, and all the distress and irritability turns into rage.' Now, this goes back to what you and also you quoted Tompkins as saying, that affects cover each other and are interchangeable with each other. And I read this as, he feels so hurt and vulnerable when he imagines you're disinterested, that the only way he can initially express that is through rage, as opposed to saying how hurt he feels. Does that seem like a fair characterization?
Yeah. And that's sorting out, I think you put your finger right on it. That's beginning to sort out how he feels, what made him feel that way, what's happened in the past that it resonates with, et cetera, et cetera. And then instead of just the expression of affect, one's one's beginning to be able to get into the subtleties of this and help him understand himself better and really use some self-reflection.
We could spend our time on affects, but the book does go further, and there's a whole section on cognition. And for that, to represent that, you quote Gopnik in this wonderful experiment. You write, "Gopnik and her colleagues wondered if 18 months old toddlers could understand that I might want one thing, whereas you want another. And how did they explore this? The experimenters gave the babies two bowls of food, one full of goldfish crackers and one full of raw broccoli. All the babies preferred the crackers. Then an experimenter showed an 18-month-old a bowl of raw broccoli and a bowl of goldfish crackers, and then tasted some of each, making either a disgusted face or a happy face. Then she put her hand out and asked, 'Could you give me some?' The 18-month-old gave her broccoli when she acted as if she liked it, even though they would not choose it for themselves. This which suggests the toddlers had the capacity to understand another person's perspective. That is, the toddler differentiated herself from the experimenter's self, the beginning of self and object differentiation, as well as empathy." Now, this is the interesting part to me. Gopnik also studied 14 months old. These younger children, after tasting the broccoli and goldfish, always gave the experimenter what they, the children, liked, the goldfish crackers. This suggests a developmental change in this area as children get older. Literally, you're describing, or they're describing, between 14 and 18 months, the capacity to see the other as the other develops in the way they were able to measure.
Yeah, yeah. That was remarkable when I read it and talked with her about it. And she highlights so beautifully how that kind of transformation, and also how much more inquisitive in their own way they are than the adults. So they would put down different kinds of toys or this or that that worked one way or another, and the babies often would get a handle on what was making the toy work far before the adults would, in terms of what had to be put where, or this or that. They'd get it. They were more, they were experimenting in a more productive kind of a way. Anyway, really neat.
And the literature also points out that 18 months is a period where sexual differentiation becomes a heightened area of focus for toddlers.
There we go. It's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. The then section goes into words, and we won't have time to develop it further, but you have this, again, wonderful vignette. You write, "The toddler years provide spectacular opportunities for enhancing intellectual and emotional development. Language is a large part of this, opening up entirely new worlds of growth during the early years. I once overheard a toddler with a new toy saying, 'I am excited, ecstatic, exuberant.' Another time, I saw a father point out a puppy to his 4-year-old daughter and say, 'Just think, that puppy was in its mother's tummy just a few weeks ago.' And his daughter said to him, 'Uterus, Daddy, uterus.'"
Right. and that's what Annie Katana.
Exactly. That's we're on the same page together, Paul, because that's the next quote I wanted to bring forward. Annie Katan, you write, was a child analyst born in Vienna, and then she moved to Cleveland after World War II. And you write, she made three important points. First, she noted that verbalization of perception of the outer world precedes verbalization of feelings. And this is a quote from her. "Usually the child is not so quick at learning words to express the inner perception of his feelings. The child perceives feelings and expresses some without words, crying, laughing, facial expressions, body movements. However," and here is the main point, quote, "these feelings are not usually given names. Often they are not understood by the parents. The task of parents is much more difficult. They have to guess at the child's feelings." Then you write, Katan's second and third points derive from her first, the importance of early verbalization of feelings. Her second finding was that verbalization led to an increased mastery of self-control, that is, not acting on feelings immediately, but instead mobilizing greater self-reflection and delaying action. Interestingly, she noted that, quote, "we found that the children demonstrated a mastery of their feelings and that this mastery led secondarily to a feeling of greater security." Third, Katan suggested that verbalization aided in distinguishing between wishes and fantasies on the one hand and reality on the other, to differentiate between pretend and real. And again, these are aspects of mental development that we work with in adult treatments and certainly in analysis, where we explore pretend and real. And for all of us, there can be a blurring at various times. You want to describe for us how you apply this? You have a lengthy case on your analysis of Mark, a 4.5-year-old who came to you initially. He was mute outside of his home. He began losing bowel and bladder control at school and had episodes of being inconsolable. You want to give us an overview of your work with him?
Yeah, very briefly, and all credit to Judy Yanoff, who really in the literature tackled this whole question of alexithymia beautifully, beginning to, mention how she talked to it. She began to get a sense of what was going on. She said, "I began to speak to Jeremy in another language. I made noises. I became the soundtrack to Jeremy's play. A punch landed, pow. A guy fell thud. A car collided, crash." And then she began to put it into to words and feelings. That was just what I did with Mark, and it followed up on what Bosch and Ghetto talk about in terms of an alexithymia that these kids don't know, or adults don't understand what feelings are and how to put them into words. So with Mark, he wouldn't talk, so we played, and I did what Judy did, and it was quite remarkable. He ultimately, established an alliance and was able to use these words and then start putting the words to feelings, that he was angry about something or distressed about something, or et cetera, and then we started morphing into putting them into affects.
This is a continuation of the theme of finding the affective surface, the emotional language that you can talk to a patient about, whether it be a child or adult. And you're saying with Mark, the way you did that was not to give ideas or words, but to literally say to him, pow and crunch and smash, to work with him on a guttural level, essentially, until he felt that you could speak his language, quite literally.
Exactly.
once he felt that between the two of you, he was then open to having you add higher level notions to what these guttural senses was. And there's a parallel to how the treatment progressed, as you write. It first went to guttural, and then theme of football and wrestling, and then board games, which are one step removed from that guttural. So the treatment really progressed, but your point, if I understand it right, is that you had to meet him where he was, and that was what the consultant helped Dr. B do with her patient as well.
Right, and that's where the understanding the child in development comes into play, because it's going right up the same stages. At the end of the treatment with David, for instance, David finally gets it and has calmed down and is doing brilliantly. And he's still about in this quote, maybe 8 or 10 years old. He got upset about something, went out to the porch, and his dad found him. And he was able to say, "Daddy, I was very angry at you. I didn't know if I wanted to talk to you directly about it or come out here and calm myself down and think about it first." I mean, who says that?
Yeah, that's really lovely. That's great. Yeah, yeah.
He turned out to be the president of his college as he continued on. At any rate, it was really interesting to see.
But to jump to this other important thread in your work, something that can inhibit all these developmental steps that you've been describing so carefully and beautifully is physical punishment. You write, "Physical punishment can be as damaging to children's healthy development as physical abuse. And most recent research questions the traditional physical punishment abuse dichotomy. Physical abuse tends to occur during episodes of physical punishment. Verbal abuse is also at issue here, as it can elicit the same development-damaging affects as physical punishment and abuse: distress, anger, fear, and shame, with denigration and disruption of self-development. The term corporal punishment and spanking tend to obscure the understanding of the impact of physical punishment. Many people do not know that corporal means the body, or physical. Spanking is a euphemism for hitting. Spanking is a euphemism for hitting. One is not permitted to hit one's spouse or a stranger. Such actions are defined as the crime of battery. The puzzle and persistence of physical punishment are not simply abstract issues. Profound individual psychopathology and social problems are indisputably associated with physical punishment. And you list, later on, some of the impacts of physical punishment on later development in society, and just a sampling of them is that there's more approval of other kinds of violence, there's more impulsiveness and less self-control, risky sexual behavior as a teenager, more crime perpetrated as an adult, less probability of graduation from college, more violence against non-family persons, more drug abuse, more sexual coercion and physically forced sex, just as a sampling of the many examples. Tell us about your work in this area, Paul.
Well, very briefly, it's to try to jump on the train that you just started, you know, to suggest to people what happens and that there's more of it going on than we thought. There are worldwide now a number of countries which have totally deleted physical punishment. And it turns out when they've done follow-up studies in those countries have much less violence in general than just the physical punishment of children. In the United States, there's still, I believe it's 17 states that still allow physical punishment in schools, in public schools, and only 5 states in the union that have prohibited it, not just in public schools, but in private schools. And the example very quickly I'd like to give is if you're in a school where there's physical punishment and the person takes the board out and whacks the kid a few times, at that point, it's okay, supposedly, legally. But if you go 10 feet from the school out into the sidewalk and there's the same board and the same person, the board has become a lethal element and the person may be charged with battery and assault. It's like, what are we thinking? How are we thinking about these things? So yes, I think not a lot more important issues than physical punishment of children and understanding that now.
When you see families, and I don't know if you do, but if you see families where physical punishment is part of their repertoire of discipline, if you will, how do you engage with both the child and the parents?
I think then we go back to the beginning of the book. What are the feelings? What's happening? What was done to them in their own past? Is that how a parent tried to get a child to understand something rather than with words? Just kind of a psychoanalytic approach. Let's start with the feelings. What were you feeling? Can we be curious all about what you were feeling and what happened then and how you were feeling about it? Physical punishment that took place, et cetera. It's often so ingrained that it's not so easy.
Oh, for sure. I want to make sure we have time to mention your foundation. Want to tell us the name of it and how it functions and what your involvement has been?
Very, very quickly, it's an impoverished area up in northern Wisconsin, and we began to realize that the kids up there were really getting short shrift in terms of education and all. So it's Wausaukee is the name of the little town, one of the little towns, the Wausaukee Charitable Foundation. And we started granting scholarships to kids as they came out of high schools. Well, we recognized two things that were of psychoanalytic importance. First of all, was if, as so often happens, one gives only one scholarship for 1 year, it doesn't persist. That growth does not continue necessarily. So what we started doing was saying, okay, we'll attend to you and we'll give you, you know, if you keep your grades up, we'll give you another scholarship for the next year and for the next year and the next year. And that's been terrific. But the main thing gets back to psychoanalysis, that we provide them with a mentor to help them through and help them understand what they're getting into and take care of their, deal with their tensions and their anxieties and what may be going wrong in their adolescence is leading them to sway away from the education. And it's really been spectacular over 10 years to see these kids get all the way through college or welding school or goodness knows whatever it is they've gotten into and come out on the other side. It's been remarkable. And it's not that easy. It's easy to see and it's not that hard to do.
And just to be clear, the spelling is WASAUKI Charitable Foundation?
It's WASAUKEE. It's up north of Green Bay. They're all Green Bay Packer fans.
Of course. Paul, we have to close with Lincoln. This is the last paragraph of your book. You write, "Perhaps in the meantime, we could do worse than recognize the assets and liabilities of affects, cognition, and language in development, clinical work, relationships, and societies, becoming increasingly self-aware, focusing on interest and curiosity, and using them to fuel our capacities for empathy. We might also do well to recall a small segment of Lincoln's annual message to Congress on December 1st, 1862. Delivered a month before he signed the Emancipation Proclamation and when he was in the midst of trying to preserve the Union and end slavery. He said, "We can succeed only by concert. It is not, can any of us imagine better, but can we all do better? Object whatsoever is possible. Still the question recurs, can we do better?" Paul, your work, your life's work, is a profound inspiration in the world of trying to do better. It's the basis of all of our work, but you really take it to the nth degree in all the areas that you focus on. And I'm grateful to have learned from you over all the years we've known each other and to have the chance to read your book and study your book and to spend time with you talking about it. So thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Want to thank you so very much and right back at you, all that you've done in the field and with the program that you're doing now. It's really great, Harvey, and it's been a pleasure to call you as a friend and as a teacher of mine. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.